Hey folks, and tonight's episode is brought to you by YesPleaseVintage.com. If you're in the States and a fan of vintage and upcycled housewares and clothing, give YesPleaseVintage.com a check for clothing, jewelry, homeware, and some really awesome finds. So go check them out now at YesPleaseVintage.com. And currently, if you spend over $60, you get free shipping on all orders. Hello and welcome to episode 109 of the Asian Cinema Film Club. I'm your host as always, Edward Jones, and joining me of course is my co-host, the Professor, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Hello there.
On tonight's episode, we look at the Filipino comedy Super Parental Guardians from 2016. But before we were started, it's time to ask what you've been watching. And Stephen, what has been holding your interest, if anything?
Unfortunately, I'm going to have to say I haven't had the chance to watch anything in the last week, so other than tonight's film, so I'm going to let the audience down. How about yourself?
That's not yourself. I've watched things, but they've not obviously fallen into our wheelhouse. Apart from obviously tonight's selection, which I watched, and I also started watching a Netflix series which has popped up called Risky Business Japan.
Okay, that sounds fun.
Now, a lot of people have been saying to me this week, they've been questioning the fact that, you know, we mark our episodes as explicit because, you know, there's occasional bad language and, you know, this ain't your daddy's Asian film club. And it also allows us to talk about programs such as this. Now, if you were in the UK in the pre-internet times, you will probably remember a show hosted by Anton de Cons called Eurotrash, which he hosted with Jean-Paul Gaultier for the early seasons. And this was basically a thinly disguised culture show, which mainly consisted of porn stars and naked Germans. And in the pre-internet times, this was the way that British kids got to see something a little risque. Again, mainly naked Germans.
Yeah, so it was... I think we've talked in the past about lads mags and things like that, Bizarre magazine, things like this. Sort of this whole sort of, there was a sort of a 90s laddie culture, and I think Eurotrash fell into that kind of 90s. It is the 90s, isn't it?
That sort of it is 90s, the 90s. That 90s it also thing. Fell into that late night programming block, which no longer really exists.
Yeah, and I mean, I remember it as part of my... We'd go out to the pub. So in the 90s, I would have been in my 20s to my 30s, before I had kids. And it would be part of our Friday nightish routine. We'd go out, we'd have a few beers or whatever, and then we'd come... This is when I drank as well. These are halcyon days. And then we'd have recorded on our video recorder Friends, Frasier and Eurotrash.
And oh yeah, that's right, they're all part of the same block, weren't
they're all
they?
They're absolutely all part of the same block. There's a couple of other shows that may have sort of flitted around it,
and it would be in South Park as well.
Yeah, maybe South Park, maybe I'm thinking there's a few other sort of things, but
it's like this guilty was in that one as well.
It's sort of like this sort of guilty pleasure, because all the other stuff is very much American stuff that was coming down, and this was like, Anton de Cons was this strange, crazy French TV presenter that I think was only famous in England.
he's a director in France as well,
right?
And yeah, he's this very charismatic French guy who speaks with a very broad French accent. And he's paired with Jean-Paul Gaultier, which anyone who knows anything about fashion will know that the man is Campus Christmas. And the two used to play off each other and throw innuendos around.
Yeah. I mean, Jean-Paul Gaultier only came on latterly, didn't he? Initially, it was just Anton de Cons. And... I'm pretty certain. But it was the magazine show, wasn't it? And there were just like these clips. And we have this in England, or the UK, we have this history of this kind of clip show. Let's look how funny Johnny Foreigner is, right? What's the fella, the Austro? Clive James did it. And Chris Tarrant had one, didn't he? On ITV Sunday night. There'd be this funny look. And Chris Tarrant got famous, the Japanese show. People would get humiliated and have
endurance.
So it was kind of an update of that, but it was full of here in Amsterdam. Here's the Museum of Willies, and here's someone who wants to be who in Austria who acts as a nude cleaner for you every day, and it was all very. It was kind of rude, but. It was a bit beyond the seaside smutty postcard, but it was boobs and middle-aged people you don't want to see naked in thongs and that kind of stuff, wasn't it?
It was. The thing is, it was presented as you said, it was presented as this cultural program where they just had funny little bits about different cultural things around the world. And they use these humorous voiceovers to voice all the people that they interview. But like you said, it would be like, oh, look, here's the Museum of Willies. Here is the family that create, I think there's a family that made dildos or something. And they would have all these little bits, or it'd be something about like how someone's produced a book of Italian hand gestures. And then they would just show them interviewing a bunch of Italian men on the street doing gestures for big boobs or whatever.
Oh, and Lolo Ferrari. She was like part of it. So I don't know if you remember Lolo Ferrari. But Italian porn star stroke politician. And they sort of were a big... I think she's passed away now, hasn't she? But
she did. She sadly passed away in the early 2000s, I believe.
Yeah,
so.
That's right. But, you know, she was in on it as well. And it was just, hey, look, here's a bunch of Johnny Foreigners. Look, let's look how silly they are. But at the same time, Decone and Jean-Paul Gaultier are fully in on the joke. And then it's the joke's on us as well. It was entertaining. I miss... he had the show before called Rapido, didn't he? That predated Eurotrash. That's what Anton Decone came for. Rapido. Right, sorry, you're giving me a real 90s nostalgia rush.
But you see, when I think of like the 90s, I think of like Vids, which was like Steph and Nige in the video shop. Two Welsh guys. Are they Welsh or are they Scottish?
I don't remember that, but they sound Welsh.
I think that they were Welsh.
You've just reminded me of the other one, but keep going.
They were these two guys, and they looked at videotapes, and it's through there I just got about kung fu movies and anime and horror films, because they were like basically doing the sort of bottom barrel crawling that I would turn into a career for a brief period.
I just remembered the other show was the Adam and Joe show, which was
with.
Who are still sort of
Adam Buxton is a successful podcaster, and Joe Cornish who would go on to attack attack on the block.
Attack the Block, and he was one of the original writers for the original Ant-Man movie for Edgar Wright. They still got, even though it all got thrown away, they still got a lot of money for writing it.
Well, and Edgar Wright was doing Spaced, which again was also part of that block, and he did that with Simon Pegg and Nick Frost.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who would obviously go on to... Basically, anyone you saw in like the Three Cornettos trilogy is more than likely would part of this Channel 4 block.
Absolutely, yeah. Channel 4, they had previously had a really successful block in the 80s, when they were started, of course, where you had the sort of the comedy... Oh, what was it? Adrian Edmondson and the gangs. What was it?
The Danger like Boys.
Yeah, but there was the whole...
Big Bomb like, and...
Things like Five Go Mad in the Country and stuff like that. I can't remember what their troupe was called. And we also had like our version of Saturday Night Live, Good Friday Night Live, hosted by Ben Elton, who's obviously gone on to be an author and playwright and stuff like that. But this was like their second phase. And to me, it was just all in this this laddish culture, which was tied up with that New Britannia stuff with Blur and Oasis and Spice Girls. This was all, I don't know, it was just a thing, and it was the 1996 European Championships. To me, Eurotrash was all part of that. So with that long aside, what have you been watching again?
I've been Netflix has just put out a show this week called Risque Business Japan.
Right.
And this is very much in the Eurotrash vein. So if you watch Eurotrash in the 90s, you will feel very familiar with this show. Basically, you have these two Korean guys. One's a singer and one's a stand-up comedian. And they're looking at the sexy side of Japanese culture. And in the first episode, they're looking at sex shops, which aren't just like the little pokey hole in the wall that we have over here marked as private shop, but they're like a whole building. They go to one and it's like five floors, and each floor is like a different thing. And it's and they have like the top floors, which is just like the men only. But it's, like I said, having grown up in Eurotrash, it's got this real sense of familiarity to it, and the fact that they're just there joking between themselves, and they're absolutely like flabbergasted of like the things that they discover. Because I said they come from Korea, they haven't got this sort of culture that obviously exists in Japan. But, I mean, as I said, someone who plays a lot of Yakuza games, you'll really appreciate the first episode, because they're in Akihabara.
Akihabara, yeah. In
Akihabara, Tokyo. That's where the first episode is. So I said they go to this huge building, which is full of various sex toys and couple things, and they're busy like amusing themselves looking at things, and the staff who are just so overly helpful to talk about said things, and they also find from there they go on to the DVD hotel, which not only has an all-you-can-eat curry bar, but also has a shower, a washing machine, and dryer. And it marks itself as the rival to a hotel. And they interview like people actually in this DVD place where you can go and you can watch DVDs. And you, as I said, you rent a room and you can stay the night. And they're interviewing these guys, and they're like, oh yes, if I get off work and I've had too much to drink and miss the train, I often stay here. And it's like, great. and this is probably the time that like Japanese people like really, really sort of like appreciate the fact that a lot of them still wear face masks.
Mm.
So they're not just like outed by Netflix, because this is a Netflix exclusive as well, as being the guy who goes to the all-night porn barn.
Right.
But yeah, this is the first episode. The other episodes in this series has them obviously meeting adult actors. They go to a hostess bar, and they also look at dating, sex, and love life in Japan. So yeah, a lot of things that feature in Yakuza games. So
I'm all for it.
Because don't you make just, friends with the guy who owns the naughty video store in Yakuza?
I'm pretty certain that you run all kinds. The wonderful thing about the Yakuza games is that they do live in there's this hard crime element to it, and then there's this weird in Japan stuff, I guess, which obviously is what this show is picking on. You know, there'll be I think one of the early missions in one of the games is you basically end up finding this group for adult babies, these grown men being babies, and it's never rude, but there's always a bit of wink, wink, nudge, nudge, and I think there's always been this fascination. And we see it in some of those more out there Japanese films where you've got this culture which is very rigid and hierarchical and, let's face it, misogynist and racist and homophobic. But then there's this little section over here that's just weird to us anyway. But I think it's weird to most Japanese, and it's like the escape from this rigidity is this what we call outrageous. You know, we've all heard about the gachapon machines where you can get schoolgirls' knickers out and stuff like that.
That's a popular one, isn't it?
And I don't know sometimes if it's real or if it's some kind of manufactured fakery or it's literally one machine in one place that's in the red light district of Kyoto or something like that, or if it's really a common thing. You hear about the compensation dating culture, I think, which we've talked about before, weird fetishes here and there. So this sounds like it's feeding on that. It does sound like, if it's like a Korean show, that does sound like the sort of culture that would like to poke a little bit of fun at the Japanese. Obviously, you know, there's a lot of tension between Korea and Japanese. Like, what's it called again? Sorry.
It's called Risky Business. Are you looking to add it to your watch part now?
I am. Every time I look for Risky Business, it just gives me...
It's Risky Business. If you go into what everybody's watching, it's at the top of the pile, unfortunately.
It does sound... You've given me the whole... Oh, I found it, yeah. So it's a South Korean show, gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's, as I said, you've got these two guys who are a really charming host because they're taken from very... You see, you're playing it in the background now.
Well, okay, I'm
wait until we finish so you can go watch the naughty show. But yeah, as I said, because the guy who's a singer... apparently he's been learning Japanese and he acts as the translator, and he will often like point out some of the bizarre signs and stuff that they have. But it's as I said, if you are nostalgic for Eurotrash, if you're, as I said, if you're a certain age, and certainly if you're a Brit, this will feel very nostalgic to you when you watch it. I've only seen the first episode, which is amusing on so many levels, especially when they go into the BDSM basement. And it looks like when you walk into like those mom-and-pop hardware stores, and they've got like the wire racks with like the hooks jammed in them, towed up like zip ties and stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, that's basically what their basement looks like, and it's just like all sorts of BDSM stuff.
Gotcha.
Including another really helpful girl who's there, like, just to advise them on what they should be buying. But at the moment, I'm not sure which has been the more eye-opening experience, this or the one with the small children going to fetch groceries.
Oh, well, that's a very good show, and they only last like 10 minutes. You mean the ones where they go on their own?
Yeah, the old grown up, because I know that SNL picked it up, and they did one which was like, it was like grown-ass men is like, when are you going to go to the shop? Mascara.
Yeah, I mean, that show was quite the lockdown phenomenon, wasn't it? Squid Game and stuff like that.
That bizarrely horrified me more than this show has so far. And I remember saying on the show that it was just like, I was getting like so anxious watching this small child walk down the road with a flag so he doesn't get run over, and the carefree like voiceover when he was sort of like, he's like, maybe you should ask a cop. He's like, is that it? No, it's not. As you're waiting for this child to be like snatched off the street, and I know you and Kim were like, oh, but you can see the camera people, and I'm thinking, yeah, like, still see the small child wandering down the street.
It's not even that, is it? I mean, I think it is very stage managed, but it's just the point of putting these kids in even fake peril, right? It's still happening to them, right? It does feel totally wrong and exploitative. And it reminds, you know, I've reminded you of Endurance, you know, which I'm certain is taken out of context. I've just remembered another show that we had, was Banzai. Which now, I don't think, I think, was the Great Bert Kwok not part of that? I'm pretty certain he was.
Yes, Banzai was a UK production that had various Japanese characters, but it was styled, as I said, after the likes of Endurance and stuff. It was all like those sort of like in-your-face sort of graphics, and the idea being that they would have people doing various challenges, and you, the viewer, will be given a multiple choice outcomes, and you picked your outcome, and you know, you got to see if you won or not, and you could play it with friends or just by yourself. The DVD took it one step further, where if you, every one you got wrong, you had to put a number in for the vets. And if you dialed a whole number, then you had to put your pet down.
I mean, I always equated it to, do you remember the, on the Nintendo DS, the WarioWare games?
Yeah.
Where it was like little 5-second games that some were nonsense, some were real. And that's what I always thought of Banzai. They're just nonsense, short nonsense things. But it was incredibly racist the more I think about it.
You had that. And they mixed it up. They had they had these characters that they used to harass celebrities with. So you had Mr. Shaky Hand, who had to shake hands with celebrities as long as possible and had a little timer. And then you also had Lady Wong Question. And the inserts were all filled with, like, 80s pop music. Like, War of the Worlds and stuff. And because I remember they had the War of the Worlds theme by Jeff Wayne for Lady Wong Question. And they decided it's like, Lady Wong Question! Dun, dun, dun! Da-da.
Yeah.
But yes, it was Bert Kwan who did the... He did part of the narration. There was two guys who did the narration, but again, it was very sort of stereotypical Japanese style sort of like commentary, which at the time was very funny, and I don't think it was intended in a very sort of mean-spirited way, but I think, as I said, I don't think it's sort of show you could do now. And the same thing a lot of people said about a lot of stuff that you featured on Goodness Gracious Me that you couldn't do now. Which again was four British Indian performers giving their commentary on the British Indian experience, really, and like poking fun at their own culture, and as I said, they were the ones who came with the amazing skit of going out for an English, which was about how English people act when they go into Indian restaurants. So yeah, there's a lot of things that, you know, we came up with which I don't think you could do now. So when you have something like this show, Risky Business, it's fun to sort of embrace it for the light-hearted entertainment that it is. And yeah, it is very much, as I said, if you watch Euro Trash, you'll find this very, very nostalgic, because it is sort of like, oh, isn't this wacky, as you watch these two Korean guys being openly like shocked by this situation. And even, as I said, as a Brit, you still, the fact you've got like the adult video watching place, and the fact that they have food, which always reminds me of like when you go to the adult theatre and they sell popcorn. It's like, are people buying food here?
Yes. So, no, I'm gonna be honest with you, mate. I'll be watching all 6 episodes before
I should have told you before we came on, and then we could have talked more. But we'll obviously talk about it more in the next episode, because we'll probably
we'll watch. Yeah. I mean, it's only 6 episodes, and they're only 30 minutes each. That's right. I'll be eating that up, and then we'll come back. But yeah, thank you, because you've given me a real 90s nostalgia as well about how my Friday nights used to be before the highlight was recording with you, which is no criticism. It's just life's different now.
It's, there's a lot of like late Channel 4 in particular was like the master of the late night TV. And I know that Jonathan Ross's brother said that his thanks to late night TV was able to put his kids through like university and stuff, because all his gigs were late night TV, like hosting bizarre game shows and things. But yeah, I think now of like all those late night TV shows you used to watch on Channel 4, and like I said, you had Bits, which was a video game show. You had Badass TV, which again was another, oh, isn't foreign TV funny? Which was also followed up with Love is a Dog, which had a real obsession with this Spanish soap opera called Love is a Dog for some reason.
Well, it's probably a mistranslation or something, wasn't it? But yes.
Probably, but something then, like that.
But it was all, you know, it was all this TV, even if it was like an American import, or if it was some kind of cheap, you know, it was all easy to produce, either because someone already produced it, or it's just a clip show kind of a deal, or a cheap, like you say, a cheap Paul Ross fronted game show or something like that. But it would always produce some kind of water cooler moment on for Monday morning. Did you see what happened on Euro Trash, or did you see that ridiculous game show? And I think Channel 4 had lots of misses as well. They didn't all succeed. Did that awful nudist thing with Keith Chegwin. Was that a Channel 5? That might be Channel 5, actually. But yeah, and that, I mean, Channel 5 was a newer thing, wasn't it? That's right. I mean, that was a one-off. I mean, I think Channel 5 tried to replicate it. But I think this was all before Big Brother and reality TV. And now what they can do, well, that after these shows, then they filled the schedules with whatever the latest reality TV show was and its spin-off. And yeah, I kind of miss those days.
Sadly, now late night TV is nothing but legalized gambling, phone shakers and South Park reruns.
Yeah, pretty much. But I'm gonna cheer myself up with nostalgia. So,
do you want us to leave the room?
No,
it reminds me of the Electric. It's like sit on their coats on laps, song in your heart.
I'm gonna go and torrent a whole bunch of Eurotrash episodes. In fact,
I think it's all on YouTube. I think it's on all four. Even
I think that, you know, there's a DVD producer in this country, I think, called Network Films.
They put out all of them.
I think they've just done a set of Eurotrash, like in the last few months.
I believe so, because I remember everyone our age telling me to go buy it.
Yeah, because they don't do fantastic quality full of extra features DVDs, but they pump out British TV shows from the 70s, 80s and 90s, entire seasons with incredible regularity. And I got to admit, I'm sure I saw the Eurotrash one, and I'm sure I did think, I would like that.
Okay. Eurotrash is available to buy on Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
I'm just having a look in the shopping section. There's a T-shirt section. Where's a T-shirt section for this? Yes, Eurotrash the series. How many discs is this? 20 discs. You can get 20 discs, that's 16 series, for 76 quid.
Oh, that sounds like a bargain.
And on the I'm looking at the cover now, and it's got Pee Pee and Popo, who were the rubbish cardboard giraffes. I'm just remembering, it's all coming back to me now. You have Mr. Penguin, because you had the oddball cast of characters, and Britain's contribution, Mr. Methane, a man who can fart at will.
Ah, Mr. Methane, of course, yes.
And there was was it Wally? Who was he was kind of like the European Johnny Cash or something. He was some guy with a bad dye job who just used to come on and he's like, I get you.
Okay, so at networkonair.com, which is Network Films website, it's only £69.
Of course.
Right, so if you want to buy us 69 coffees, and we'll do a Eurotrash dedicated podcast for 16 weeks for each series. No, don't, because I think our minds would rot.
Challenge us.
But yeah, I have to say, I mean, as you know, I'm quite the nostalgic king. I have to say, I think I get emails from these people every week. I think, I'd like that.
Yeah, just like the TV and the people who like put out The Champions or The Sweeney or Minder, like very old like TV shows that the people may want to watch in DVD but don't really care about quality or special features.
Yeah, but they also put out a whole bunch of British films which are, I think most of them are like copyright free now, but you wouldn't get them, you know. And I mean things like from Brief Encounter to, I don't know, ridiculous sex comedies from the 70s that are useless. But a Capricorn 1, it's the only place you can get Capricorn 1 now. It's the only place you can get the Captain Scarlet movies. You know, like they do quite cool stuff, but they are not.
That's a completely different block when you say Captain Scarlet, because that's the
dun, 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 dun,
the BBC
dun,
dun. 6 o'clock block.
Indeed.
Where you used to watch Simpsons and you got a Gerry Anderson thing, so it was Thunderbirds or a Stingray or Captain Scarlet. And then on Saturday mornings, you got Joe 90.
Yeah. The other thing Network have got, they have all the Michael Apted, you know, 7 Up, 14 Up, 21 Up, all those documentaries, which I used to bloody love until about.
Oh, that's like this, the one where they
follow the same children from the age of 7 and I think it's still going, apart from Michael Apted, of course, has passed away a couple of years ago, didn't he?
So I think they started with a different group of kids.
Have they? That's a disappointing one. Because it was kind
a Millennium
of
in Child.
Oh, that was a slightly different thing. But yeah, this one was, and we were shown this at school as well. I kind of grew up with these kids. I mean, they were sort of 10 years or so older than me. But yeah, anyway, Network Films, networkonair.com. If you're British and you're feeling nostalgic, send some money their way. It's nice of me not to advertise Arrow for once.
Send us your trash book set and we'll review it.
Absolutely.
You know we're going to end up just like on the cover and just like kill off whatever's been left of the audience that we haven't killed off already in the first 30 minutes of this episode.
They've all come for some Tagalog films and they're getting the best of Benny Hill, £6. But also multiple versions of Black Narcissus. So, you know, again, it's very weird. Oh, God, it's got the Margie Clark boxing film. Blonde Fist. Oh, my God. I'd forgotten
that. I remember that.
Oh, right. I need to close my browser window.
Right.
Let's move on.
So, yeah, that's been the only thing, the only highlight of this week. It's been a strange week because with Arrow Player removing the Puppet Master movies, I've binged a lot of Puppet Master movies. And, yeah, I hit that point where the money ran out for Full Moon Features and they start recycling footage. And it has to be said that, you know, while they didn't have a lot of money for certain entries in this series, they're really doing the whole Roger Corman thing of just really making it work. When you see directors like David Cato, like what they're doing with the material and stuff, it's really phenomenal. And it's all like that Japanese, the sort of workhorse mentality that we see with like certain directors, such as like the early Mikkei movies, where it's just sort of like a director with a budget and a vague script just making it work. So, but on that note, it's time to move on to tonight's feature presentation, which is 2016's Netflix exclusive, The Super Parental Guardians. Tayong mga Pinoy ang hihilig sa mga yugyugan. Makarinig lang ng bayola, kangiti parang Pasko na naman. Etong si bebe ko, ang gumiling na kasmal pa ewan. Ale-alem pang sumayaw, ang akala mo'y kinukulang. Okay, so tonight we'll talk about the Super Parental Guardians from 2016, a Philippine action comedy starring Vice Ganda and Coco Martin. The film is directed by Joyce Burnell, and it tells the story of unlikely parents Arcee, played by Vince Gallardo, and Paco, played by Coco Martin, who receive custody of the children Megan and Ernie, following the death of their mother. And along with the pair, they try to find the gang responsible for her death, which leads them down a wacky hijinks-infused action comedy. Stephen, this was your pick.
I've just seen your rating on Letterboxd. I'm absolutely flabbergasted, but we'll get there. unless you're fooling me.
I mean, this is the thing, because like I said, it's not been the best week that I've had. And finding like a couple of hours to myself to watch this film that you picked out for us. So,
okay, yeah. We'll get there. So, my reasoning was, and I think I talked about it last episode, is that we haven't covered anything Filipino at all. And it's a huge market in the Pacific Rim, right? And it's got this really interesting kind of background that it's obviously got its own native background, but it's also got the Spanish language background, and it's got the American backgrounds, and the language is, you know, there's multiple languages, although Tagalog is the one that's usually advertised, but Tagalog is also infused with all, it's a bit like Singaporean English, you know, it's just infused with words and things from all over the place, and when you hear people talk, it's like they're flipping between multiple languages. it's a real, you know, it's a really vibrant film culture as well. So, you know, you and I one day will talk about Weng Weng and all those sort of exploitation movies.
It's on the list.
On my, you know, from my background in that, my knowledge is really from people like Lav Diaz and these 5 hour long art films and things like that. And one of the things that I did on my blog back on the day when I did it was do Japanese and Korean and Thai films that were just populist. They were just film, you know, they weren't art house films, they weren't cult films, they were just films for everyday people, you know, the kind of stuff that we watch now, the comedies and the action films, and they're not high art, they're just there to be entertained. So I had a look on Netflix and saw that this film, and in 2016 when it was released, it was the biggest film of the year in the Philippines. And I picked it at random, it was on Netflix, I looked later to see it was an incredibly divisive movie. And when I watched it, I thought, oh my god, what have I done? It's also a movie, having watched it, I think it would drive some of a certain type of right-wing person absolutely insane to know that it's on Netflix. if you're transphobic or have issues in that world, this is not the movie for you. And good would be my view on that. Then you fuck off. But the other thing is, because it was on Netflix, I was really interested, like, who the audience is, because it's also, as often these films are, I think I like quite a lot of Hong Kong films where they're quite contemporary based, and you wonder, A, if you don't live in the Philippines, or B, you don't live in 2016 anymore, whether any of these jokes make any sense. But I don't know. How did you find it, sir?
This was certainly an experience, to say the least. I had very low expectations going into this movie. I think I had no expectations going into this film. And I was actually strangely charmed by this film. Much like so much in something like De Niro's The Intern, there's certain movies that you go into with no expectations, or you just catch you in the right mood, and this was certainly one of those films. As it's a film which is both an action film and a comedy, and delivers fantastically on both fronts. Certainly we open with an action scene with the local warring gangs, with Paco heading up one of these gangs, and they engage in this really incredible street fight in the slums where they got bats and they got darts, and it's a fight that takes them over the roofs of these shacks and down the ground before they get beaten up by the local neighborhood association, who, rather than write some stern letters, turn up and beat everybody with sticks.
I have to say, that opening scene is pretty fucking magnificent, isn't it? Some of the fighting's a bit like, you can see they're not really hitting each other and stuff like that, but the camera work and the way that it goes, like you say, over like a shanty town, isn't it? And they're sort of going over these multicoloured roofs, and the camera's moving around, and there's these darts that they're flinging through catapults. That, again, everyone, there's a little bit of comedy, but it's like really well done. And I thought, oh, hold on, this, what is this film? I thought it was a comedy, right? But it felt like it was going to be something a little bit darker.
It certainly hits into the lighter end of like films such as, like, you know, The Raid or The Night Comes for Us, in the fact that you have, you have this gang leader named Paco, who's kind of known for starting gang wars in their neighborhood. And I've now remembered that there's a film that I did watch as well, because we were watching this one, that I will have to save till next week. But Paco is, as I said, he's a bit of a hothead. He's gets in this brawl. When we say this fight scene, as you mentioned, Ray, there's a certain element of slack foo involved in some of this fight scene, but the other parts of it are really nicely choreographed. And the whole time it's shot with a wide lens. It's not shot close up like we would expect, like Western films to be shot. This is actually shot at range, and you get to appreciate some of the movements.
It's not Paul Greengrass or whatever, you know, it's not Jason Bourne, let's shake the camera around and film it so close up you can't see what's going on either. It had a bit of a I don't know, a bit of a Shaw Brothers-y feel to it to me, you know, the way that you can see everything that's going on and it's in wide angle. I liked it.
Yeah, and at the same time, the sloppiness adds to the sort of charm of it, because as we expect, I mean, these are street gangs. These aren't trained martial artists. They're basically there to sort of, like, attack each other, and they carry, like, sticks and chains and things. So it has a sort of realism to it, the fact that they're not the greatest skill fighters, and at the same time, the choreography is kind of inventive and really sort of adds to the sequence to really sort of raise it above just being just a simple throwdown. On the opposite side of things, we've got RC, as I said, played by Vice Ganada, who works as an executive assistant to Marif de los Santos, who is the wife of a local general. And he's kind of like this RuPaul-style character. He's sort of like a drag queen and social influencer, and he hangs around with a group of other drag queens.
And I believe he's basically playing himself, right? He is this outrageous, you know, he's this kind of outrageous homosexual type, right? You know, that's very openly flamboyant and gay, and, you know, wears these amazing outfits, but he's also appears to be 6 foot tall and a guy, but it's just accepted. There's no, I mean, there is a little bit of criticism, but only from the kids later on. But the grown-up world just seems to accept this, which I think is marvellous.
Yeah, Gernardo's someone who wears many hats. Is a comedian, talk show host, television presenter, actor, entrepreneur, and singer. He, and this is a pronoun that he's used.
Yeah, I had to check as well.
We're going to, if you're offended with use of pronouns or terminology in this episode, you know, I apologize. He is responsible for starring in eight of the Philippines' highest grossing films.
Yeah, he's a big star, unlike anybody that we've covered in the previous 108 episodes. I think I just don't think we've seen anything like this. But clearly, there's a market for it in the Philippines.
What we end up with is essentially this odd couple relationship, where the two will inevitably figure out how to look after these kids and find that their differences are actually their strongest point. This is the long and short of this film, and
it's got moral. It's got a moral at the end, hasn't it? Of that sort. And
it's kind of funny, the fact that there's a film bookended by two action sequences. As we get the showdown at the start, and then we get a showdown at a station when they go to when Paco and his guys go to rescue the kids when they end up being kidnapped by this crime boss that's constantly shown in the shadows. And I have to say that the reveal was certainly disappointing. But we'll leave that to you to watch and find out.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, and at the end it does sort of goes into sort of film parody. So there's a big Train to Busan sort of parody that happens at the end. Actually, it is quite funny.
There's even a Pokemon
Go thing, isn't there? Yeah.
Thing which makes no sense whatsoever.
I mean, yeah. So I think that's the thing about, so like you say, it's bookended by these two big action sequences. So you know, and it's fucking dark, right? So basically, Paco's sister, who's an unmarried mother of two, who will get to those kids, used to go to college, I think, with RC. So they seem to know each other. And when they get together again, the mother is murdered, tells RC that she needs to look after the kids, or he needs to look after the kids. She bequeaths her kids to him. But Paco obviously says, it's my sister, I'll look after the kids. I'm not letting a gay like you look after it. But then sort of they come together and sort of work to look after the kids together, as you say. But yeah, there's one of the main characters is murdered at the beginning. There's a gang war at the beginning. There's this background story of this sort of murder cult that's literally murdering people for being addicted to things. And I think there's some kind of meta commentary going on about the war on drugs under Duterte in the Philippines over the last 8-10 years. But it's a really weird thing to just, I don't know, this is real tonal dissonance where this is a sort of political commentary, and people are also getting murdered because I think the first person's murdered for being addicted to earbuds or something like that. Is that
this,
right?
This gang's called Atticus Anonymous.
Yeah.
And as we said, Sarah, the mother, she's addicted. She's murdered because she's addicted to balut or duck eggs.
Yeah, that's right.
So much so that on her funeral tribute, that they placed duck eggs
and chicks.
Yeah,
yeah, but it's it's just weird, and I don't know. I did sometimes have a hard time laughing at the jokes because I thought, hang on, there's some quite dark stuff here. But we've seen this before. I've seen this before. There's 1,000 Hong Kong comedies that are like this. There's 1,000, well, not 1,000, but you know, this. We watch a Stephen Chow film, and quite often there has this real mix of quite dark stuff along with slapstick comedy. And this is kind of what it made me think of, is like a Stephen Chow film where, although it's not like Stephen Chow type comedy, this is like RuPaul, as you said before, with sort of bitchy wordplay that I'm not convinced all of it is translated terribly well. I watched another review by a Filipino reviewer earlier, and they explained, you know, they didn't explain literally to me. I just watched their video, but things like, you know, like the young boy that is, you know, he's incredibly camp and clearly a young homosexual kid. He wants to be called Megan, and the joke in the subtitles is that he wants to be called Megan, like Megan Fox. So, you know,
does say that, yeah, though, doesn't he? So, yeah, because they're introducing themselves, yeah, and no, Megan's the girl though.
No, they're both boys.
Okay.
Yeah. And
okay. I thought it was a short haired girl.
No. They're both Megan, boys.
Megan comes up and it's like, I'm Megan, as in Megan Fox. I had no idea that. That she was a he.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So they're both her sons, but he's obviously, you know, he's like a proto RC, and that's why he's bullied at school. A, because their mother's been killed, and B, because he's... I mean, they do say, oh, you're a gay and stuff like that. And he's into dancing and he's into fashion and stuff like that, which is why him and Arcee kind of bond. But yeah, but the joke, he says, I want to be called Megan, like Megan Fox. But actually, in Tagalog, what he's saying is it's Megan, as in Meganana or something like that, which means beautiful one. So they've had to go and translate some of the jokes to make them more understandable to us. But yeah, I hadn't realised you hadn't realised that. Yes, he's, he's, to me, that kid's the star of the show. He's fantastic. And I just think it would upset so many seriously people with some issues that I'm quite glad that happened. So yeah, he's quite cool. And then there's Ernie, is the youngest boy, who's just cute.
That's basically the whole thing. I mean, Megan, it said, is more the... She's more the attraction, and he's the psychic. Because they often do seem like just doing... Everything they do is sort of like a double team. Like, she'll do something, and then he'll do in a complimentary bit beside it. Yeah. But, yeah, again, I thought Megan was a girl.
Ah.
And because of the young age, it also, you don't... It seemed to all slot in. But he has some great lines such as, he's sort of like, do you really want to mess with me? I'm wearing hair braids.
Yeah, that's some lovely stuff. Oh, there's a lovely bit where, I can't remember what the reasoning is, but they sort of all go and beg on the street or something like that. And Ernie does walk like this and does a little impression of what a beggar would be. And they're just, the pair of them are utterly charming. I know it's a trope, right? I'm sure we can both think of films where you have some kind of action comedy film, and there's two cute kids who are both hyper real and stuff like that. This
was the West, they were being incredibly grating and horrible characters.
That, yeah, absolutely.
Whereas these two are just really charming. And sort of add to the tit for tat that we've got going on between Paco and Arcee. And the real charming aspect of the film is that you see this sort of relationship growing between Paco and Arcee. The fact that they play off each other so much. Like the fact that Arcee walks in on Paco in the shower. And she's there being like a lingering perv. And he's calling her out. On the situation, he's sort of like, oh, you sitting there staring at me, and he's like, I just wandered in, he's like standing by the door and stuff, and the fact that Paco has a rat's tail,
yeah,
which is another real interesting look.
Yeah, I mean the actor Coco Martin is kind of interesting because he's like this darling of Filipino indie cinema, right? And he's got this, you know, if you look at his back catalogue, I have seen Kinate, actually, so I have seen a film with him in before, but it's this mix of these he's also quite a star of LGBTQ cinema, these quite arty dramas. And then these ridiculous comedies like this. Whereas, obviously, Vice Vigander is just what he is. He's just an outrageous character playing pretty much himself in every movie. But we've had this before. I'm going to get nostalgic again. But, you know, we've had... you know, I don't want to date when we recorded this, but, you know, Barry Humphries died this week.
He did, who was obviously Dame Edna.
And most of his career, he was playing this role on TV. I think there's been some film appearances and stuff like that.
There was the earliest movie, I mean, it's an exploitation movie where he's playing like a Dane Edna prototype, where he has the great line of lesbianism has always left a bad taste in my mouth, and he says it with that high pitched like twee accent.
I mean, to be fair, Dame Edna was a different thing. You know, Barry Humphries was not gay. This was coming from like a more like a music hall kind of men dressing up as women for comedy, you know.
It was
Les Dawson and...
It was like Lily Savage, really.
Although Lily Savage is coming from that drag, that sort of gay culture drag thing, whereas Edna Everage is coming from, I don't know, people like Dick Emery and Les Dawson. Just comedians would dress up as women, right? Hinge and Bracket, that's the classic one. I don't even know, that might predate you either.
Or Leslie Calf. It was Steve Coogan's sister.
That's right. And Steve Coogan was definitely leaning into that. So, but, you know, we have in the UK, for sure, we have a huge tradition. And I know Barry Humphries was Australian, but I think it's fair to say that...
He's part of the Commonwealth.
And I think his fame was very much driven from his success in the UK.
Yeah, who could forget Dame Edna's Neighbourhood Watch on Saturday nights? And my dad used to constantly point out that, you know, he's just a man in a dress.
And it didn't matter. Yeah, we have this weird dichotomy in this world where our cultural world was full of homosexuality and drag, and, you know, even on the radio, people and Carry On films, you know, Kenneth Kenneth Williams and people like that, and Frankie Howard were clearly homosexual, but we just used to look past it, and there would be men making oral sex jokes dressed up on panel shows as women, and we just go, yeah, but they're not gay, they're just men in dresses. And we literally thought as a country that Freddie Mercury was straight until like the day before he died. And my children look at me like, well, how on earth could you have thought that?
But the band's called Queen.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, he was, what did you, the phrase you used earlier, was it camper than Christmas? Yeah. George Michael, you know, we could, Elton John, we hurrahed Elton John's marriage. Stuff like, anyway, but yeah, we have this culture, and I just think this flamboyant character that Weisgander is playing sits in that world. It is so outrageous. It is so flamboyant. It also feeds into this sort of modern culture of Instagram beauty and stuff. I mean, the introduction of the character in this film is all about someone, you know, they are an assistant to some woman who's, is she the wife of the general? I can't remember.
She's the wife of the general. And basically, RC is supposed to be the assistant. She's been tasked with looking after a house while it's being renovated.
Mm.
Which, again, is just an excuse to have a bunch of shirtless builder types who look nothing like any builder I've seen. They're more like a male dance troupe.
They're like Asian Chippendales, aren't they?
They are. And the fact they spend pretty much the whole movie shirtless is just completely gratuitous.
Yeah. And she's got this gang of other transsexual people around her who don't pull it off as well as he does at all. And I believe these are characters that are well known to the Filipino populace. They are equally sort of, it's not like, you know, there's that character in the Stephen Chow films, the guy that's always dressed in a, just as a woman, but he's got a full-on beard.
Yeah, it's...
Yeah, it's a bit like that, where there's this incongruity between them.
And that's where the comparison I was drawing the whole time watching this, and I'm thinking, this is just basically like a Stephen Chow movie, but they're sort of leaning more into the transvestite character. And the episode obviously being this, like, kindergarten cop-esque comedy, where you, as I said, you've got these two, this odd couple relationship between these two guardians. You got a couple of charming kids who create situations for them to resolve. The main one obviously being a parents' day. So Arcee turns up as both their father and their mother, but these are like just the most completely outlandish characters. When he dresses up as a man, he's just like a male model, and he's there like lifting his shirt, and he's like, I didn't know she had abs. And yeah, like pouring water down herself. And then he goes away, and he like comes back as the mother character, but it sort of like looks like he's the Duchess of Kent, and he's got a toy dog on a lead. All those little yappy dogs.
Oh, do you know, when I was watching it, I'm like, what the fuck is this? But then there were these wonderful set pieces, and I'm thinking, but that's really funny. What's wrong with me?
Even, like, then they get into the talent contest, and of course they recruit the builders, who also happen, again, this must mean they are the Filipino Chippendales, because they have this perfectly choreographed dance routine, where at one point they bring out this big pole for Megan to be hoisted around on.
Yeah.
And then they sort of double down by throwing RC up in the air like a bizarre cheerleader routine, which just seems an excuse to show off a lot of panty shots on her.
But it is, I'm just in this dual mode where this is shit, but it's also quite hilarious. And also, like I said, there's this tonal dissonance between the sort of the plot and the things that we're seeing. And I'm thinking, I'm really pleased to see what you put down as your letterbox score, because I was expecting zero.
It goes one or two ways. So you look at letterbox, it's half a star or 4 stars.
Yeah,
there's no middle ground at all with people who watch this.
I felt I had to apologise to you before I even knew, because I thought, oh, this isn't the film that I thought it was going to be. But I was going to sort of say, but I kind of enjoyed it. And I think it's those set pieces that I enjoyed so much. I'm not sure I'd want to sit through it again from minute one to minute, however long it is. I can't remember, it's about 2 hours long, isn't it? But I would certainly enjoy watching the clips on a YouTube compilation again. That's the crazy thing.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything to like really warrant a like repeat viewing of it. No. I mean, it's certainly an entertaining watch, but it falls in that same sort of entertaining watch of things, as I said already, like when you watch De Niro's The Intern, it's sort of like, oh, that was a heartwarming little comedy. You know, it's like good on De Niro for doing something different than his usual gangster shtick. And I know a lot of people like really bagged on The Intern of him like doing it. So like, he's an older guy. He's playing a role designed for an over actor. Like, God forbid he branches out a bit.
I mean, yeah, obviously De Niro's had that whole... I didn't like the films themselves. Well, the ones he did with Ben Stiller.
Oh, the Meet the Fockers trilogy. Yeah,
I mean, I thought... I saw the first one at the cinema. And
the first one's funny. The two that followed really weren't great.
I didn't even like the first one very much. But I was like that. I thought, what on earth is he doing there? This is like one of the greatest actors of our generation. What's he... Even the bloody title is just a shit joke. But I get it. I get it.
It was worth it just for the joke they did in Bad Neighbours where they have the De Niro party. And he's there with the fake cat. He's like, I'm watching you, fucker. I'm watching you. And you got the guy who's there like, just doing Samuel Jackson impressions because he has no clue what Robert De Niro's actually been in.
Yeah.
And then in the background, they're all going, hoo-ah! They're like, that's not even De Niro!
But, yeah, I mean, these silly films exist, right? Mm. And they're there for us to enjoy, right? Not every film has to have a deep meaning. Not every film has to be a victory over... creativity over budget, you know, all those things that we laud films for. Some films are just there to entertain, and the criticisms that I saw of it were mostly either you don't like this kind of knockabout camp comedy, or that surely they should be making films that are much more serious than this. And of course they are, but people need to be entertained. I've also just seen that Vice Gander has made a version of Private Benjamin called Pray Be at Benjamin, which now I want to see because that's a film I've always liked, Goldie Hawn's Private Benjamin, and I'd love to see a Filipino gay version of that as well. So
well, the director behind this, Joyce Bunnell, is also responsible for directing the third State of the Nation address from President Rodrigo Duterte.
Duterte.
And she was tapped to direct the fourth and the fifth as well. So yeah, it's kind of funny when you think of this director who's obviously on one hand's obviously directed this light-hearted comedy, and at the same time is sort of the hired gun in the Filipino industry for like directing film and television. And this is actually one of the highest opening day grosses for Filipino films at $75 million.
Yeah, I mean it. I think it was the highest grossing film of 2016. But I think it's still in the top 10 highest grossing Filipino movies of all time. I think that's what I saw. The Filipino film industry is a big thing. There's a lot of jokes in this film, went over my head, mate, but where RC's referencing TV and film stars that obviously we don't know, and they sort of, she says, oh, you look like this one and you look like that one, and or I'm dressed like this one, and it just means nothing to us. But it's a big thing, right? Same way, you know, like South Korean culture is a big thing. Yeah, I think there's a lot of big stars that are famous in the Asian Pacific rim countries that just means nothing to us. And I guess, you know, there's quite a big Filipino diaspora, isn't there, like in America and stuff like that. So there's a lot of that stuff going on that these are just, we don't understand. But then again, we're two white guys that review Japanese and Hong Kong movies, and I don't think, but we do know quite a lot about those countries. We just need to learn, I guess. Not that I'm saying we're going to be doing crazy crowd-pleasing Filipino movies for the rest of our run, but it's actually...
Well, this is always one of the aspects of doing the podcast, that it was about branching out from the three main territories, obviously Hong Kong, Japan and South Korea, and that through this show we've obviously got to look at many other interesting areas of Asian cinema that you're surprised constantly that they actually have film industries, never mind booming film industries.
Yeah, absolutely boom. And we haven't covered a lot of comedies either, I've noticed. So I'm glad we were both entertained by this.
Comedy's difficult to do on podcasts because you're essentially telling the audience why something's funny.
Oh yeah, and retelling the jokes which are there on the screen, and yeah, absolutely.
And I think this is the other good thing about this film is the fact that it's, because when it's an action film, it delivers, and when it's a comedy, it delivers. And there's a lot of, it throws a wide berth of different styles when it comes to the comedy. You actually have, like, the jokes, which are obviously going to be more in tune with Filipino audiences, and then you have wonderful slapsticky moments in this film. And I know a lot of people say this, like, kind of like vaudeville and sort of like very sort of like bottom of the barrel humor. But then again, when we look at what bottom of the barrel is over here, and this is still miles ahead of that. This isn't like most of the Adam Sandler Netflix output or most of the things that Rob Schneider's been doing recently.
And it's not mean. I think a lot of comedy can come across as quite mean, if do you know what I mean? It's like picking on people, and this film is not mean, right? The jokes are usually at the teller's expense. It's not quite self-effacing, but I never felt anything in this film was anything done with anything less than the best intentions. Even though it's quite catty and bitchy, and it's a weird thing to say, but
you've got this. As we said already, you've got the tit for tat between Arcee and Paco, and then you've got their own individual things where Arcee is flamboyant and Paco is a klutz.
Yeah. He's also a stuntman as well.
Which makes, that was the part I was trying to figure out, because obviously he's got this very distinct skunk tail hairstyle, and yet he's also playing this suave James Bond-esque character, well, a stunt double for a Bond-esque character that in this film production that seems to be just randomly filming on the streets.
Yeah, these are just high concept ideas they're flying out. It is, I think that, the connection you made to like a Stephen Chow film is quite right. It's just, it feels like some of it's being made up on the fly, and they've had there's a skeleton of a plot, and they're just putting vice gander around it, and I'm all right with it. I think you might be more all right with it than I am, but the more I talk about it, the more I think I realise I enjoyed it. It's really weird, and a film that's, it's only, like, as you say, it's only got 2 out of 5 on Letterboxd, but I think it's because it's utterly divisive, and I think it's because it's on Netflix. So I think a bunch of people like me are saying, oh, look at this film with the exciting, almost superhero kind of title name, and then it's not the film that they're expecting, and they're disappointed. But I think a lot of people say, hey, this is hilarious camp fun, let's have more of it.
Yeah, it's definitely, there's certain moments in this film that's really sort of shining, and I just felt the whole thing was very sort of largely offensive and sort of like a very sort of gentle comedy. That, as I said, going into it with sort of like rock bottom expectations to be pleasantly surprised. So, yes, I was, this was another interesting discovery, to say the least. And is currently sitting on my top 50 film discoveries for this year.
And we're only in May. We're not in May yet, actually. You know, we're only in April. We're only in April as we're filming. So, yes, could be interesting. Might make your top 100. But it might get on the...
If it's still going to be on the 50 by the end of the year, it's hard to...
Will it make to our 250 episode or whatever we're going to have next? I can't remember where we are with that.
Well, that's the other question, really, isn't it? So, currently, when I'm looking on the list here, this is between Triangle of Sadness and Brian and Charles at number 32.
Oh, you are such a man with your list.
And it's below 3,000 Years of Longing, which is the George Miller, yeah, I'm going to throw style at the screen movie.
Yeah, it's a film I'd like to talk about one day somewhere. A film I enjoyed... But
was it that final act?
It was the final act. Yeah, it was. I thought it was. I mean, George Miller. I think we might have had a talk about George Miller when I watched it, actually. You know, this is the guy who's done Babe and Mad Max.
And Happy Feet.
And Happy Feet, yeah. And Mad Max, Fury Road. And, you know, he's got this... And I thought it was a... It's just a wonderful, glorious... It's another camp fest in some ways, isn't it? And you've got, like, Idris Elba and Tilda Swinton being iconic, as both of them just are. And then the final act, it's just a bit rushed, if that makes sense.
Does it count as Australian cinema? It's the real question here. Because if it does, we've got a show we can cover it on.
I don't know. Because... Yeah, because the director's Australian, does it count? But all the stars are English. Yeah, clearly it's got American money. Don't know. But yes, that's a film I enjoyed, but...
I'll work it out.
Indeed.
Anything else that you want to talk about in this one?
No, I don't think so. I think we've talked about it far more than I thought we were going to be able to. So I think I'm claiming an accidental win... Even though it was a bit of a random throw of the Netflix dice.
Fantastic. If you obviously want to check out the film Parental Guardians, it is available to watch on Netflix. It's an exclusive, so it should be available in all territories. And yeah, it's come to a recommendation from us both, it seems. But that brings us to the end of tonight's show. Thank you as always for listening. If you haven't already, please do hit the like and subscribe button wherever you happen to listen to us. Leave us a review, as it will help raise the profile of the show. You can follow us on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, and come say hi to us there. And you can also check out our blog, which is asiancinemafilmclub.wordpress.com. But next time, it is my turn to pick. And we're going to be moving away from comedy into something darker, a film that I've... been really interested in covering on the show for some time. We put it up for a vote and unfortunately didn't get chosen. And it's sort of like been this last week and so it's been sitting on my mind as a film that I really wanted to cover because it's sat on my watch list for some time. So on the next episode, we're going to be looking at the ultra dark I Saw the Devil.
Bloody hell, right? That's a tonal shift.
As I said, it's been on my watch for some time now, and while we obviously are going to this year, our 30 days is obviously going to cover horror films, I feel that it's going to be a film that we need a whole episode to cover, and obviously I couldn't guarantee that you, our wonderful audience, was going to pick it, because you know there's often something else that grabs your attention on the list whenever we put it up, so...
Have you not seen it before?
I've never seen it before.
Oh my word. Yeah.
And so... You've recommended it. The guys at Kissing Contest have recommended it. I think the guys over at Junk Food Dinner have recommended it. Team member Steph has recommended it. So.
Oh my word. I mean, you're in for a treat. I mean, obviously you've got stars like Choi Min-sik and Lee Byung-hun, you know, who we would have seen. So Choi Min-sik from Old Boy and Lee Byung-hun from a film we covered... Where the guy's the gangster. Beautiful Life or something? No, what was it called? Bittersweet Life.
Bittersweet Life, yeah.
Yeah, and also I think he's Snake Eyes, isn't he, in the G.I. Joe films.
Oh, no, he's Storm Shadow.
That's right.
He's a white ninja.
But it's directed by Kim Ji-woon, who is like one of my... Well, he's the director of Bittersweet Life. Tale of Two Sisters, which I know you've loved.
Yep.
And this is a... dark serial killer film, and it's going to, I promise you, it's going to tick all your boxes. That's, now you're going to say, God, it was rubbish, but no. Oh, I'm so excited. I'm really excited about this. I didn't know where you were going to go at all. So one of my favorite directors, two of my favorite actors, and a film I love. So there's spoilers for you. I'm going to gush. Well, it does mean it's going to be a very dark week for me when we watch it. I have to balance it out with some risque business.
It's certainly going to be an interesting week for you then.
Indeed.
So, but that's coming up on our next episode. But until then, thank you as always for listening. And thank you to my co-host, Tim.
Pleasure. Pleasure as always.
And we'll be back next time to talk about I Saw the Devil. But until then, good night. Hey! 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 Kinono-ko-i-wa-wasurete Kinono-ano-ko-wa-wasurete Odori-tsuzukete-itai Yoru-nano-sa Tsuki-ga-kudake-chitte-mo Hoshi-ga-moete-ochite-mo Odori-tsuzukete-itai Yoru-nano-sa Mune-ni-sasatta Wasurete kino no ano ko wa wasurete odori tsuzukete itai yoru nano sa.
This podcast is a proud member of the LAMB Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.